welcome to the next episode of the Food Fight Show. My name is Nathan Harvey. I'm your host for today, along with my co-host, Nell Shamrell. We'll say hi to Nell in just a second. I'm coming to you live today from my beautiful home office in Annapolis, Maryland, where it is hot and muggy today because that's what happens in the Mid-Atlantic in the summertime. Nell, how's it going with you?
Hey, going all right. Coming to you live from my home office in Seattle, Washington, where it is hot for Seattle. We've had 90-degree days the past 2 days, which I know many of you in the Midwest or the Atlantic will probably scoff at me, but keep in mind, most Seattle homes and apartments do not have air conditioning. So I have been literally taking ice packs and putting them around my body when I'm trying to get to sleep, just to cool down enough to sleep. So it's good to be back here on Food Fight. I know it's been a while since I've been on the show. There have been some big things happening with Habitat, and I am thrilled to be back.
Speaking of, like, I think first, maybe this is the first time. It's certainly the first time I'm going to say it publicly. Congratulations, you were recently promoted to a principal engineer at Chef.
Thank you so much. It's an immense honor, and I hope I can live up to the faith that Chef has shown in me and has placed in me. So thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, no doubt you will. No doubt you will. Speaking of, you said you've been very busy with Habitat. What's been going on there lately?
So I became the Habitat Core Plans lead a little bit before ChefConf. Core Plans, I call it my 500-headed Hydra, though it's 600-some-odd as of last count a few days ago. Basically, these are Habitat packages that are ready and available for anyone to use. We package a lot of common software from Apache to Nginx to WordPress to almost anything that you can think of. That's not a challenge, by the way, but to almost anything that you can think of. And we make it very easy for someone to pull that dependency into their Habitat plan by just saying, hey, I want to depend on Nginx in the core origin on Habitat Builder. All I need to do put in my plan is depends on core Nginx, et cetera. So that has been a very big job. We recently did a massive refresh of all the plans. So Habitat has some base plans. And what a base plan is that's basically a plan that's required to build almost every other aspect of Habitat. So thing about Habitat is when you rebuild one plan, it also rebuilds all the dependencies on that plan and all the dependencies of those dependencies. So if you rebuild, say, glibc on Habitat Builder, we have to rebuild every single core plan that depends on glibc, which almost everyone does, and every single plan that depends on dependencies of that plan. So it's quite the yak shape, I guess you could say. It's just an army or armada of yaks. I think I like that because they swim. But that's what I've been up to. It's been great to interact with the community so much in their work on Habitat Core Plans. If you want to get involved, check us out.
Oh, that's really awesome. And I know you did earlier this week some internal almost like an internal webinar about core plans. And I thought that was really informative. And hopefully we can turn that around into something that's a little bit more public in the
near— I hope so.
Yeah.
The conclusion my team and I came to, we made a team charter, and we were trying to figure out, all right, are we this little lonely island on the Habitat team and Chef? And the answer is no. It turns out every single aspect of Habitat, every user of Habitat depends on our work. And Chef Automate is now packaged with Habitat. Every single aspect of Chef Automate depends on our work. So I don't know if we were quite ready to settle that weight on our shoulders, but we're glad we're aware of it now. And I think it shows the value in what we do.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Hey, so I myself have been pretty busy lately. Actually, I'm happy to say that July was a pretty quiet month for me. I mostly stayed home. Although it is now August, so I'm back on the road and doing a bunch of great things. Last week, I was out at OliCon, which is the observability conference, and that was really cool to watch kind of a burgeoning community around this idea of observability come together and share ideas and practices with one another. Next week, I'll be out at Redeploy, which is a conference, brand new conference this year also. It's happening in San Francisco Thursday and Friday. I believe it's Thursday and Friday. Pretty certain it's Thursday and Friday, but it's all about resilient engineering and building resilient systems, both the systems that we, you know, build and manage and put into things like clouds and data centers, but also human systems. How do we build more resiliency into the things that we're doing? Other cool things that are coming up in the Chef area and sort of out in the world, we'll be at the Sensu Summit, which is on August 22nd and 23rd out in Portland. I'll be down in Sydney for the DevOps Talks Conference. That's August 27th, 28th, and 29th. And then, of course, we have our community summits coming up very soon. So this year, we're doing two community summits. one in Seattle and one in London. Both of these community summits really are for anyone that's involved in the chef community, whether you're looking at, you know, automating infrastructure with Chef, compliance automation with InSpec, application automation with Habitat, all of that is happening. So Seattle is October 2nd and 3rd. The real focus in the Seattle summit is on the people that are out there doing development work with Chef, with InSpec, with Habitat, with Chef Automate, and so forth, and contributing to our open source projects. So those 2 days, first day will be open space discussions. We'll get together and figure out what we should talk about, and we'll go deep into those topics. The next day is a hack day with lots of hacking, building out projects, doing demos, and so forth. So that's going to be super fun. Again, that's October 2nd and 3rd in Seattle. And then 2 weeks later in London, October 16th and 17th, we have our next community summit. This one purposefully has kind of a broader audience and a broader appeal than just developers, I would say. So in that one, we're going to have some product updates, some demos, some customer success stories and case studies. We'll, of course, have some open spaces, but we're also going to have some hands-on workshops, which are new this year for the London Summit. And then another thing that's new this year for the London Summit, you'll have the opportunity to take a certification exam. So if you're on the path to becoming a Chef Certified Developer, you can sit one of your exams while you're there, earn another badge on that journey. So lots of good stuff coming up in the next couple of months I'm excited about.
And I get to go to the London one this year, which I am so excited about and looking forward to tea and theater and seeing all the wonderful chef community in Europe, many of whom I haven't met yet. So I will see you all there.
Yeah, it's awesome. Awesome.
So when you go to summit.chef.io and register for a community summit, be sure to use the discount code FOODFIGHT to save 10% off those tickets.
Hey, well, let's get on with our show and let's see. So today we're going to talk about this practice, this job, this role called product marketing. And we have a couple of product marketing managers on the call with us. And I think it's fair to say that both of our guests are relatively new to the role of product marketing or product marketing management. And so let's, without much further ado, let's go ahead and get them introduced. So we'll start off with a first time Food Fight show attendee, participant, Chris Short. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Appreciate you having me on.
Man, it's our pleasure. So, Chris, for our listeners, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your background.
So I'm Chris Short. I spent time in IT before the dot-com bubble, so that kind of dates myself. After the dot-com bubble burst, joined the Air Force for a few years, did some stuff, some cool things, got hurt, separated in 2010, been working in sysadmin DevOps since then. And just recently, in late June, I transitioned over to Principal Product Marketing Manager at Ansible.
Awesome. Well, we're really excited to have you on the show. Ansible is a fun tool that's out there in the same space that Chef lives. But that doesn't mean, I mean, maybe we are competitors, but we also love each other. And you and I get to hang out at conferences from time to time, which is always good.
I love you, Nathan. That's all that matters.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, I tell people often when they say, oh, you know someone who works at Ansible or Puppet, and they say, isn't that counterproductive? And I tell them, I don't have a quota. My concern is that you use the best tool that's available for you. And if that best tool is Chef, fantastic. If it's Ansible, fantastic. Let's just get you successful.
Yeah, that's awesome. It is unfortunate. Like, everybody loves a good fight. And in fact, we call this the Food Fight show, but we... You know, we're usually pretty congenial and pretty happy and peaceful on this show. So anyhow, on to our next panelist, Julian Dunn. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Nathan and Nell. It's good to be back.
How are things going with you?
Things are very good. Things are extremely busy. So I guess I should introduce myself, because the last time I was on the show, I was definitely not in this role. So I'm director of product marketing at Chef, and Chef is a much smaller company than Red Hat. So I'd probably do a lot more things to a smaller degree of depth than Chris does, but my background is in product management. Prior to this, I was product manager at Chef for 3 years. And then before that, I was a consultant for Chef. And before that, my background is in systems administration and DevOps. And prior to that, I was a software engineer. So I've sort of been all over. I get bored really quick. So that's the reason I've jumped around a lot, do a lot of different roles.
Our product manager on Habitat, Tasha Drew, I know has referred to you as the Tim Gunn of product marketing. You tell us what works and what doesn't work, and you're usually right.
And there's usually a stream of GIFs that then ensue in the channel, because there are a lot of Tim Gunn animated GIFs out there. Or GIFs, I don't know how you pronounce it. That's a source of debate.
Speaking of fights.
Exactly. Speaking of fights.
Yes, let's do it.
And Julian, it seems like you've had so many different roles at Chef. My question to you is, when are you going to move to accounting?
I haven't sold the software yet. So maybe that would be my next stop. But yes, I have never worked in accounting, HR, or sales. And I think that's about it.
All right. Well, it'll be fun to have you back on the show and we can talk about how accounting and DevOps are related to one another and budgeting and all of that. That would be great. But today we're talking about product marketing. So maybe we'll start just with a definition. Chris or Julian, do you want to take a stab at what exactly is product marketing and what is the role of a product marketing manager?
Ooh. I'll let Julian take that one.
Okay. I mean, technically by the book, the way people describe it is, well, the product marketing manager or product marketing function is there to message and position products to the market. Now, what the heck does that mean for the layman that's listening to this show? Effectively, what my job is to describe what the products do, how they actually help solve customer pain, and really try to make it and turn it into from something that's really, really philosophical or visionary into something that folks can actually apply on a day-to-day basis. That's really what messaging and positioning is about. Now, from that sort of core, there's all kinds of other additional activities that we do. If you think about explaining what we do to people, it's like not only explaining it to our users and customers, people that actually make those decisions, but also so that I'm not flying around the country like a madman. So part of my job is also training sales reps, how they should pitch and talk about the product. And then also, part of my job function is also serving as a spokesperson for Chef as well, dealing with analysts again, same kinds of things, right? When we come into, you know, analyst reports and things they have, you know, there's these instruments like Forrester Wave and the Gartner Magic Quadrant and these sorts of things, right? So it's talking to them and explaining to them how the product works and how we actually solve customer pain. And then also reporters and press. And those are typically more around specific events that we generate, like ChefConf, where a lot of reporters are going to descend on an event, want to ask a lot of questions about our product announcements, but also just generally during the year when we have big milestones around new product announcements, like earlier in the year when we did Inspect 2. So reporters are going to be like, well, what's the difference between Inspect 2 and Inspect 1? So it's a lot of different things, but that's really what messaging and positioning for the layman rolls up to. Love to hear from you, Chris, how that overlaps with what you do.
Yeah, it's very, very similar, but the difference, I guess, between Chef and Red Hat would be that, you know, I'm not necessarily going to talk to the press directly, right? Like I will inform PR and then PR will, you know, gate that conversation, back and forth. Same with analysts, right? Like I'll have an analyst relations person manage that relationship, but then bring me in when needed kind of thing. So that's kind of nice. That's two things or two groups of people I don't necessarily have to talk to. No offense to journalists or press or analysts, but I'm not the best at talking to those types of people to put my foot in my mouth at times. Yeah. So the definition of like messaging, positioning and all this other stuff, I think might be something worth diving into. And that's, you know, especially when it comes to tools like Chef and Ansible, right? There's things that it does and things that it doesn't do. And making that very clear and concise is important, I think, in this role, because if you're not doing that, you're potentially misleading people. And, you know, we're creating content for the market. Yes, the people using it, the people evaluating it, people that, you know, sign checks to buy it, but we're also creating it for, you know, our internal sales teams. And no offense to salespeople, see how many people I can offend on one podcast. No offense to salespeople. They tend to sell very enthusiastically. So the messaging that they use to do that has to be very concise. And when they need more depth, that's when we can pull out other pieces. But to get the initial foot in the door, the last thing we want to do is, you know, have our sales folks selling features that don't exist, because that doesn't make anybody anything as far as happiness or money or in general, fuzzy clouds and rainbows.
It reminds me, a company I used to work at, one of our salespeople sold an OpenStack cluster, which is fine. We do those. But then they sold it as something that had to be HIPAA compliance, which you can do with OpenStack, but we were not ready to do that at that point. So I so wish we had a marketing manager or someone to tell them, no, don't sell that beforehand.
Now that's interesting because there are some like spots where we're, you know, very clear to people, right? Like, if a potential has this, just walk away, right? Like we're very cognizant of that, at least at Red Hat, because, you know, there's no sense in trying to reinvent the wheel with some of these companies, right? Like it's, if you're very happy with Chef, I can't you know, convince you not to be happy with Chef, right? Now, if you're unhappy with Chef, I can definitely throw my hat in the ring, but there's no sense in me trying just for the sake of trying, right?
Yeah, for sure. So, Chris, speaking of, you know, using Chef and sort of the comparisons between Chef and Ansible, I'm not going to ask you to walk down those differences today, but what I am interested in is you were at ChefConf and you gave a talk there. And so I'd love to just hear sort of a little bit about what your talk was about, which maybe has nothing to do with product marketing, but I think it's a good thing for us to chat about for a second anyhow.
Wow, you're really testing my memory on a Friday, Nathan. What the hell talk did I do?
It had to do with not being war.
Oh, yeah. DevOps is not war. So, like, the premise of the talk is that human conflict is natural, especially whenever there's change, and specific change regarding, you know, the established thing, be it a government, be it a country, be it a silo in your enterprise. That established thing will always, or not always, but the vast majority of the time will conflict with the up and rising thing. So it was very much a talk about silos and DevOps, but actually breaking down the history of some of these conflicts and what went wrong and how to prevent them in a DevOps kind of philosophy. So taking a lot of history from Thucydides, the Athenian philosopher, and a gentleman named Graham Allison, who is a Harvard professor, and he has worked with every administration since like the Kennedy administration or Reagan or something like that. Been a long time. So yeah, very smart researchers and philosophers. Thucydides specifically, because he was the first person to be like, hey, you know, the gods didn't actually intervene with this. There's actual cause and effect here. So, and then Allison to come in with the idea of the Thucydides trap, which is that the conflict is the norm, not the exception, to rising powers conflicting with established powers. And that's kind of like day-to-day life, right? Like a new person comes into work and they're, you know, all enthusiastic and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, and in a, you know, poorly managed organization, somebody will sit them down and be like, listen, this is how things go. Stop trying to, you know, rock the boat. In a well-managed organization, they will embrace that and move on with life. So, yeah.
Awesome. And so, you know, you've recently made a transition into product marketing. I'd love to understand, both from you and Julian, you know, you were both engineers before. What kind of drove that decision-making process? And maybe now that you've both been in it, at least for a little bit, what surprised you now that you're in that role?
Well, so I've always kind of done some degree of marketing, right? I feel like social media or blogging or anything is a facet of marketing. It's definitely not the whole kit and caboodle, but last year I kind of tackled the idea of like building a brand for myself, which, you know, sounds very egotistical, but I started to notice that people that got their talks accepted at the conferences I was going to had a very cohesive like message. This is who I am. This is what I do. So, I started to tailor that because I often approached, you know, my personal brand before I actually focused on it into just kind of this multifaceted, I can talk about anything, you know, foreign relations or military or tech, just throw it at me. And no one really actually wants to hear about those three things all at once. So a little more focus. And that kind of led to interesting opportunities with working specifically with like social media managers or marketers, because those efforts worked to a lack of direction, but definitely like the goal was accomplished. So when I was approached with the product marketing, specifically because I was so technical, like help us shed some light on, you know, why Ansible and, you know, DevOps and all these other things, it really appealed to me because I spent a lot of time trying to help people embrace DevOps, like on the ground, writing code and advocating for DevOps. So now let's actually put some product marketing type stuff together to make it more, I don't know, coherent for the layman. Because it's a very interesting dynamic for me, especially because my boss is very much like a marketer, has been marketing for a long time, and I've very much been an engineer. So it's like a good blend of, you know, marketing savvy with like no BS kind of tech experience.
I remember it comes around every few years, but there's a screen cap someone took. I think it was Fox News explaining what GitHub is.
Okay.
And it's wrong. And if you want to look for, imagine that, if you want to look for it, you can. And what I'm getting at here is when Ansible is a product, I think largely for engineers, a lot of Chef's projects are largely for engineers, not solely, but largely. If you don't have marketing that, number one, is technically correct, because the engineers love to tell you you're wrong, and they're usually right when that happens. But if you don't have that kind of messaging, your product's not going to resonate with the people you're trying to get to use your product.
Right. Like a few weeks or months before I joined Red Hat, I was actually on a call with a customer at my previous position, and we were talking about an engagement to kind of help them embrace DevOps. And the customer actually told me, yeah, like DevOps has been a four-letter word here for the past like 3 years. If you said it, you got kicked out of a meeting. It's like, oh, like to hear that and to realize that like the internal marketing that they needed to do to kind of help them embrace just the idea of DevOps, let alone different tooling or different processes, right? Like the idea of, you know, kind of collaboration, metrics driven, you know, infrastructure and development, really kind of, it shook me that it was a four letter word, but it really shook them to say like, this isn't actually a bad thing.
I kind of made this observation yesterday as I was looking at, you know, other people's, other competitors' collateral, not yours, by the way, but people that are like, I think customers often get a bad taste in their mouth about, you know, DevOps, cloud native containers or whatever, because you have a sector of the industry and these vendors are like, hey, it's a new buzzword that we can slap onto our legacy technology,
right,
and legacy processes, and then just call it a thing. And then we'll hook some fraction of the economic buyer into buying some mainframe automation thing. And by the time they figure it out that it's not DevOps or it's not Agile or whatever, we already have their money and we're long gone, right?
Yep.
So this was, to me, one of the motivating reasons why I got into this, among a bunch of other things. But it's like, look, we want to do this right. We want to be authentic. We want to be correct, right? We don't want to like overextend ourselves, or that marketing people, particularly product marketing people in this sector that have a technical background that can at least understand and talk to the tech and be able to explain it to folks, right? Because what you don't want is you don't, and by the way, I think you had some questions, Nathan and Nell, around like, what are the other types of marketing? There are people that do other types of marketing, field marketing, there's brand people and things like that. And if you try to just drop those people into this kind of a role, then it comes out totally wrong, because what they're focused on is not the necessarily right things, right? They're going to be focused on like fonts and colors and planning events and all this stuff. But there's no focus or direction around like what's the actual user journey and the problem that that's being solved here, right? So that's one of the reasons why I got into it. And I wrote a blog post about this when I first joined, because I had a lot of people asking me, why did you decide to make this transition? Like, isn't marketing, again, just full of people that decide whether or not this Arial is going to be 32 or 36 point? I'm like, it's not about that at all. I was actually early in my career, I completely 180 degrees and changed my perspective on it, because marketing done right is both authentic and helpful and informative to the people that you're actually trying to target.
I remember, so I get a lot of vendor emails. I don't respond to unsolicited vendor emails. Sorry, any of you who might be listening, but I can't, and I don't. And there was one vendor, I won't say who they were, but they kept repeatedly emailing me. And then finally, after I didn't respond for the fifth or sixth time, they said, all right, if you can't help me, I want you to put me in contact with the person at Chef who's in charge of DevOps. And in charge of DevOps, I mean, and they didn't see the humor in it. But that's a classic example, I think, of slapping a buzzword onto something without really understanding what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm trying to prevent, especially not just at Red Hat, but just across the globe, right? Like, I was actually, somebody reached out to me yesterday, and we were talking about, like, you know, what is DevOps, and if somebody says this, is that a red flag or not? And, you know, if they tried to sell you something and said it's DevOps, I told them that, yeah, that was a huge red flag. And he was like, oh, well, that's like every company I've been talking to lately. I was like, yeah, exactly. Unless they have like some consulting gig along with their tool, they are selling you snake oil. And, you know, I've helped people migrate away from that kind of mentality often. But it's still out there, which is a problem.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to point out that, you know, the folks that are doing that aren't doing it out of any malicious intent, right? They're just uninformed and likely they're being given goals and objectives that make that the right path for them to take. And like one of the, you know, downsides of spam is like it doesn't go away ever. And part of the reason is it still works. Right. Yeah. And there are people that have these incentives that, of course, they're just going to email everyone that they can with these phrases and these keywords that hopefully will elicit a response. And even if it gets up a response from, you know, a percentage or even less of the people that they blast, they can still measure real success out of that. And so I think, you know, I really appreciate both Chris and Julian, what you've said about bringing that authenticity to this role and helping others across both, not just within the marketing departments, but others across the entire industry or within your own company, just to have more of that authenticity. And it's as much of it as anything else. It's an educational role, I would think.
Yeah. And I would suspect that Chris and I probably have a unique perspective because we have been practitioners in the past. So having been marketed to in this industry, we kind of know, like, you know, what sets off my spidey sense radar about this is terrible versus like, what is the thing that I would actually click on or email that I would read, right? And so now we're on the other side and we're flipping this around to things that, you know, that we would actually try to write things and position things that we would actually as consumers actually want to read. And sometimes that, you know, that's why I think good product marketing is almost like a good product manager where you need to have some domain expertise or at least good empathy towards the people that you're actually talking to, right? Because you can't just go and create, you know, I get these emails too, right? These people, there are very sneaky email techniques that are out there now, right? Where I don't know if you've seen this, techniques like, hey, I, you know, per my previous email, blah, 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 this kind of thing, when they hadn't sent you an email, or change the subject line to like re something when they have never emailed you in the past, or trying to like, again, get you to click on it and this kind of thing. Like this just, that's the stuff that we definitely just want to stay away from. Like, not only is it Weasley, it's just not authentic. You know, talk about physical marketing. Comcast tries to send me something that looks like an official document now, and it's just an ad in a white envelope. And if it wasn't for the fact that the USPS put commercial mail on the top right hand corner, it would look like it was like, we want to stay away from just dirty and underhanded tactics like that. We want to be authentic. We want to be solution oriented, right? We don't want to start with, hey, the way I describe it is like sort of your traditional like watch salesman type of, hey, look at all the goods I have. You want a Rolex? Do you want a Timex? Do you want a Swatch? Like, that's not how we talk about and sell products today. People expect solutions and they want you to understand what their problems are to start with, right? So the way I approach marketing is to start with, all right, so what are the, before we even get to talk about the tech, right? Before we even get to talk about the company, I understand what pain you have, and here's my hypotheses about what the pain is, right? And that's what you lead with, and what are the solutions? And then let's talk about, all right, so how does our technology help with that? And then why does Chef have a credibility as a company, right? And those are all things that you kind of leave to the end. So when you talk about, there's this great book out there about sales called The Challenger Sale, and that's basically what the approach is, right? Don't write decks that start with, here's what is me, and all this, you know, let's start with, Do we bring some insights to the customer about what other people are seeing out there, right? What pain that they're, you know, understanding that what pain they're trying to solve, right? And then actually walk into how the products actually solve for that pain.
So I think what I heard from both of you is it's difficult to trick people into DevOps.
Yes.
Yeah. You're not going to trick anyone into DevOps. You're going to, you know, and we don't, I mean, to be honest with you, Ansible doesn't have a lot of messaging around DevOps like some of our competitors do. You know, if you go to Puppet's website, I mean, they have tons of stuff about DevOps. And that's not necessarily saying that, like, we need to create that stuff, but it's helpful to have context for everything. And, you know, coming from generating the content, also coming from I'm searching for content from both sides. So, you know, a perfect example was somebody was working on like email campaigns for people that like have downloaded our software, but not necessarily installed their license. And I was like, that sounds kind of creepy. So you need to be very careful about the messaging, right? Like, don't be like, hey, I see you downloaded this thing and you haven't actually like installed the license yet. Are you interested in a trial or not? Like, that's creepy. Like, just be careful. And, you know, the person hadn't thought about that. They're like, oh, yeah, the automation just told me that they hadn't done this. So I figured we'd target them. And it's like, ooh, like that word, target, use that sparingly. It's funny because I spent all week in Denver doing like marketing training because obviously I need it. But they talk about product and market and they never talk about humans. And I think that's important to realize that you're still like, just like in DevOps, you're still working with humans. Humans have feelings. embrace them and make them feel welcome, not like a number or a sale or a, quote, market.
It's something I've noticed. I've heard this said before, and it's going to sound more sinister than I mean it, but the best way to manipulate someone is to give them what they want when they don't expect it. And I don't mean like, you know, sadistic manipulation, but I found with a lot of companies where the message of Chef or the message of Ansible really resonates are when we acknowledge the pain they're feeling. They're deploying their software is painful. And having someone understand that, particularly, you know, some product marketing manager who's technical, understand why they're feeling that way, and then telling them it doesn't have to be this hard, and then delivering on that promise of it doesn't have to be this hard. I mean, I can't think of a better way to create a trusted relationship.
Oh, yeah. When I'm writing stuff and talking to people, I'm very much like, keep in mind, I've done this before. So feel free not to, like, you know, put that, oh, non-tech user wrapper in your language. Like, I can handle that for you. Just speak to me. Tell me your challenges.
Yeah, I think you've both mentioned also how your previous experience as a practitioner is a benefit. Do you think that to be a successful product marketing manager, you have to have had that experience as an engineer or as a practitioner of some of the things that you're marketing?
I don't think so, Nathan. I mean, it's the same thing as goes for product management, right? I mean, I don't think I actually think both product management and product marketing, there's a dearth of people out there. You see companies are all hungry to hire a lot of folks, but they don't give people that have the potential the chance because they're like, well, you don't have domain expertise in whatever. If you're a product manager for thermostats or something, they're like, oh, you don't have domain expertise in thermostats, right? But it's like, they're not looking for, I think hiring managers often aren't looking for the transferable skills. And quite frankly, if you have a level of curiosity and that curiosity stemming from you figuring out how to empathize with your customers, and then how to talk to them in the language that resonates with them, that they understand. If you have that curiosity, I think you can be very, very successful, right? So product people and product marketing people, I think, can come from all walks of life. Customer success. We've had product people that have come from product marketing and vice versa. You have good product marketing people that have come from field marketing or events or this kind of a thing, right? But again, it's that curiosity and the willingness to kind of sit with the customer and really understand what they're talking about, right? Because at the end of the day, for example, I'll give you a concrete example. Where my technical background has helped is, for example, earlier this week, we did a webinar about using InSpec with Cisco iOS devices. Now, I'm not a network admin. I've never been, you know, CCNA certified or anything like that, but having a technical background lets me know, okay, where I go to find the information so that I can use the right examples and the right words so that it connects something that a network admin would actually care about. Because when you're saying what InSpec does is, for example, blah, 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 I can be like Cisco Discovery Protocol because they actually understand that, right? Or like, why would you want to keep your link down when there's nothing plugged into it, but so that somebody can't like plug in an Ethernet cable and like, you know, jack into your network and start poking around, right? But these are all things I was able to discover even though I'm not a network admin. Now, these are all terminologies. These are all things that you didn't necessarily need to have that technical background to figure out. Maybe me having that technical background was an accelerant, but somebody that's oriented in that right way that even wasn't an engineer could, with some time and some experience, train themselves to figure out how to use the right terminology for that particular domain.
Absolutely. I think the perfect example is my boss. She is not, you know, necessarily an engineer and doesn't have that super technical background, but she is very smart in the sense that she likes to learn and she knows who she should ask questions of. So prior to, you know, my arrival, I'm pretty sure she would sit down with a lot of the product managers routinely and just say, okay, this feature does what? Okay, great. Why is that a good thing? You know, what kind of person did we make this feature for? And like that, like those questions are indefinitely enlightening because as you ask them and get answers to them, you just start building more and more knowledge and you can always reference back to, you know, your notes or some of the dark caves, corners of your mind and find, you know, oh yeah, because we did this release and that release. Now it is all coming together. You could get very smart technically without ever touching any of these products.
Yep. And I would also say to add on to that, I think it's important to have that good relationship with product and engineering because not only is it like, I think a lot of engineers think, oh, well, marketing is something we slap on the end. It's like after we've built the feature, we slap it on and we market it up. Right? Like putting lipstick on a pig. But the best way to actually make sure your product is successful is for product and engineer to work with you're talking about, those would be things that you're asking at the beginning of the process or as part of the product development process, right? And for the engineer to be like, huh, I hadn't really thought about that. Maybe we should be building this feature in a different way. Or maybe we should be doing a little bit more customer research to make sure we're actually right, that there actually are people out there that are going to use it in this way, right? So in the best relationships, it's like back and forth. And these sorts of conversations happen all throughout the product development lifecycle and not just at the end.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the building a feature without research, I think, is crazy to me. And the idea of, you know, doing that now, you know you have information, right? Like not using it and just thinking like inside out kind of mentality is like, you know, customers don't know what they want, you know, kind of the Steve Jobs quote, or Henry Ford, like if I would ask my customers what they wanted, they just would ask for faster horses and he needed a car. So the idea of not reaching out to customers to an extent, I get, but to never do it, to never get feedback and to never like embrace it as part of your product strategy or your marketing strategy, I think is insane.
It sounds like a big role of product marketing is ensuring that whatever we're making is delivering real value. And there are people out there who can get value from it, whether that translates into dollars or usage, et cetera. It's just that I think I'm hearing that theme.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, we usually, in 2018, in terms of agile product development, we usually put the PM on the hook for that, but they have a lot of help. You know, in the past, you know, I think product marketing, the way it was done 20 years ago was you had inbound and outbound, and product marketing just collected requirements. It was like the proverbial bobs or whatever from Office Space. You know, I collect requirements from the customers and deliver them to engineering. And then what you got at the back was a dog's breakfast because product management and engineering never talked to customers. And we're kind of beyond that now, which means that product and product marketing are much closer together and it's much more of a dynamic and an agile relationship, right? So the idea is to minimize the feedback loop so that you're not going off and building things for a year and then putting it in front of customers that, hey, maybe it's innovative, but a customer doesn't understand what the heck it is or how they can use it. And so things will fail, right? Perfect example of this was back in the 90s, Philips had like an interactive CD system where you could play all these games and do all this.
I remember that.
CDI or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Technological innovation way ahead of its time, right? But from a perspective of what we call value innovation in marketing, complete flop, right? Because again, it's like too complicated, too many bells and whistles. What is the use case? What is the pain that the customer is actually trying to solve? And without any of that research or understanding, where the customer's like, why would I pay what was $800, right? An astronomical sum in those days for something that I don't see how it's vastly different, how it's really going to benefit me and how I'm currently consuming, you know, my media or my encyclopedia or whatever. Why is this better than my Encyclopedia Britannica, right? So that product was a total flop in the market. So the objective of doing this right is to avoid really, really costly mistakes like that for companies, right? That one particularly because it's hardware and software is a little bit cheaper, but still you don't want to waste money, right? We have a fixed amount of resources and capital to deploy it to things that actually make sense for the customer.
Absolutely. And I think the DevOpsification of product marketing is very much a good thing, in my opinion. And, you know, I know that like that circle, that the Venn diagram of DevOps and marketing is probably like, you know, just barely touching. And Julian and I probably sit somewhere in the middle there. But the, you know, another good example this morning, right? Like I'd come back from training. We had a little touch base kind of thing. And I was like, listen, we've got a lot of work in progress right now. And that's not good. We need to close some of these loops. And, you know, then we can start tackling these other things, because something like we had three or four different, like big product marketing, like pieces of collateral that were just like almost done. And we were starting up two or three more. And it's like, no, we really need to spend our time making sure these are closed and figuring out why they're not.
I've heard curiosity, collaboration, tightening feedback loops, minimizing work in progress. This all sounds like DevOps and DevOps practices to me as much as it does product marketing. So are there other things that you think that sort of DevOps and product marketing are the same thing, or are there ways that they relate to one another?
Well, I definitely think the product marketing like process that you develop inside your own team is very, very, very like DevOpsy or pre-DevOpsy, right? Like it's the product marketing person writes the thing and then hands it off to somebody else, then hands it off to somebody else, and then hands it off to somebody else. And it's like, no, can we automate any of this? I get you can't like automate proofreading, you know, to an extent, right? Like, but Red Hat has what they call like the shadow man voice or whatever in their marketing and branding. And like there's certain phrases or way of saying things that, you know, shadow man would never say. So like there's a team of people to do that. And I'm like, oh, that could totally be automated, like, you know, Grammarly or, you know, something like that. But like for brand, I think could totally be a thing. And it would be awesome to see more of that, you know, automation happening. But it is a very much a, you know, like working on design work for a PDF, like you can't really automate that. I get it. But there's, I feel like there's a lot of stuff that like there could be new tooling made to kind of help with that.
Well, I would also add to it that, you know, in terms of PDFs and collateral, what I've encouraged bringing my product management background to the marketing team is like working in smaller batch sizes mm-hmm. and running smaller experiments. Instead of trying to plan something, you know, really, really heavyweight up front and then be like, oh, well, it didn't work after you've run, like, for example, you know, we're doing a series of events in the fall. And I think it's like 10 or 15, or I don't know exactly know what, right? In the past, the way companies would have done this is we plan and lock down the agenda from day one. And then we just replicate and do exactly the same things in every city. And then we find out much later from customers how they actually liked it. Right. But what I'm encouraging the marketing team now to do is like, let's take the temperature after each one of these events and get the feedback. And then let's tune the ones that are coming up the next week. Right. And same thing with collateral. We used to do things like print, hey, let's go print 2000 copies of this data sheet or whatever. Right. And it's like, are we even going to use it? Do we know if it's right? What if there's a typo, like this kind of a thing? Right. So just, and if we don't totally know, particularly for new initiatives or new markets, if it's resonating well with the market, why are we doing that? Right. So let's run off 100, 200 at your local Kinko's. Let's go run the event, right? See how the Salesforce likes to see what the customers are picking up and not, and then tuning it and adjusting it in much smaller batches. Right. So this is much more of a agile and lean approach to doing this kind of stuff. And the other thing I would say, Nathan, to your question around like how we bring some DevOps into marketing practices, just around metrics, like how do you measure this stuff, right? And this really clicks into, again, in my view of marketing, how marketing has evolved over the last 20 years. I put one of these in my picks, which is marketing used to, again, be very brand oriented, coming from advertising agencies. And again, it was just a lot about like, again, fonts and color palettes and this kind of stuff, right? But in the last 20 years, we evolved towards what is called revenue marketing, which is basically the idea that marketing is there to create pipeline for sales. And so you can measure marketing's effectiveness in terms of the types of business that sales is closing, right? And the types of leads and the quality of those leads that are being generated for sales, right? So everything in, you know, just like in DevOps, in operations and development, you measure things in order to get better, right? So now we have ways of measuring our marketing activities so that we can improve on them. And smaller batch sizes help you use those metrics and get better very, very quickly.
So a subject I wanted to ask you two about, which goes back to the human question. So I found at conferences, if I'm helping work the booth or something, people tend to be pretty dismissive when they think I'm marketing. But once they learn I'm an engineer, the response is, oh, you're actually technical. That yes, they really do say that. I can talk to you. Have you encountered that since you kind of switched over to this product marketing management role? And how do you counter that attitude out there?
I mean, I sat down with one of our product managers who I actually knew from, you know, just going to Ansible Fest and being in the Ansible community for a while. We sat down together and I don't think he realized like I wasn't always doing marketing just because he's like, oh yeah, I got to meet with the new PMM. Even though we knew each other, you know, he's kind of down in the weeds. And like when I started asking him questions, he was like, ooh, this is not a what is, what if kind of question. This is a, why did we build this specific feature? Who are we trying to help kind of thing? You know, asking questions like that, like, you know, what about this, you know, bug report or, you know, that is very telling to people. And like, you can see, like, they shift back into their engineering mode, like mentally, and then they just start plowing forward. And then it's just them talking and it's beautiful because all I have to do is write down notes, ask follow-up questions and go, right? Like it's not very much like I know that booth duty kind of thing, having manned the CNCF booth at ChefConf. It's very much a, you know, we're having a one-to-one discussion, not a, oh yeah, you're just a marketer, I'm not going to talk to you.
Yeah, I've had it more from, again, I think that origins is because marketing is such a bad name of, hey, we just, and look, the tech industry, I think, has been terrible for this and particularly toxic towards like women and people of color, like especially with the whole booth babe thing that we, you know, the tech industry used to do in the 2000s, where you just like literally hire people to stand in your booth to look pretty and didn't know anything about anything. You know, it's like that is the taste that is often in the mouth of people, particularly with journalists and analysts and things like that. I've had people be like, well, I need you to answer some questions about this, but I don't want to talk to anybody in marketing. I'm like, look, I can code. We can dive as deep as you want into this. I can pull up my Visual Studio Code. We can go through the software and I can explain to you how it works, right? But it's just, they have this assumption about this, right? And again, I think it is the just this historical kind of record. And it's just something we need to correct over time. I'll tell you, I got some tricks. Maybe, Chris, you can steal some of these tricks too, which is like, because product is in my name, sometimes I don't say that I work in product marketing, right? So just put product. I work in product.
Right.
Nice. There you go, right? When giving talks or things like that, right? Leaving titles off agenda items that, again, people then don't immediately jump to conclusions about what you do or don't know. And then you're not spending the first 10 minutes gaining trust and credibility with them because they've made some assumption about your title. So these are some tactics that, you know, the industry is going to change much slower than we can try to impact it. But those are some of the things that I try to do sometimes. Not totally dishonest, right? I think it's like, I have a product background, so I think that's totally legit. But those are some of the things that I try to do.
Awesome. Well, I think that leaves us about enough time for our picks, but actually before we get to the picks, Chris, Julian, I have a really, really important question for you. Is it time that we call it Dev PMM Ops or
no?
Be PMM DevOps?
I think we just call it all being human with computer.
All right. Awesome. Yeah,
the neologisms are killing me, man.
Well, you know, I had to ask just to make sure that we're all on the same page, which is where we find ourselves, which is great. And we also find ourselves now at time for the picks. And this is the part in our show where we just go around to each of our panelists and ask for suggestions, something that you've been into lately that maybe our listeners would be interested in. Julian, I know you already have picks selected, so thanks for that. We'll let you go first.
Sure. So work-related and relevant to this podcast, so I put a couple books in the picks list. One is, when I first started this job, I was like, I'm pretty sure I know what this is, but let me just look around resources. This fellow, Lucas, don't remember his last name, but he wrote a book called Product Marketing Manager, and it's an ebook. It's only like $4 or $5, so definitely recommend checking that out. Very, very quick read, right? So it's good to, I mean, it's good for anybody looking to get into it, but it's good, like, every time an engineer or somebody that doesn't know about this field asks me, what do you actually do? I'm like, just go and read this. It's about 100 pages, right? But it gives you a good sense about what it is that I actually do on a day-to-day basis. I mentioned revenue marketing before, so I wanted to know about the broader space of marketing and how marketing has changed over the last 20 years. There's a book called The Rise of Revenue Marketing by a woman named Debbie Kakish. And that's also on Amazon, also really, really an expensive book. And then in terms of what I like to do for fun, so I play video games, but I play a certain type of video game that's like very story heavy, right? Really good dialogue. I mean, I'm in marketing, so I'm like a good story, right? But good voice acting and this sort of thing, really story deep. And so, long ago, I was playing this series called the Life is Strange franchise. It's really, really long, like three-part episodic. You know, you can spend like dozens of hours playing this. And then, so they wrap that series up, but they're going to start a new series with different characters. And so they've released this free preview game. So you want to get a sense of what these types of games are like. Just go on Steam and there's a game called The Awesome Adventures of Captain Spirit. And it's, you know, you're basically playing through the eyes of this, I think it's like a 9-year-old kid named Chris, funnily enough. And, you get a good sense for what these kind of story heavy games look like. So definitely recommend that.
Oh, super cool. Nell, how about you next?
All right. I too love the Life is Strange series. I haven't played the new one yet. I'm still crying, though, touch crying, not like bad crying about Life is Strange Before the Storm. But anyway, I've got two recommendations. One is Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. So there in product marketing managers probably know this in particular, there are tons of bad strategy books out there. And one of the key things this book makes clear from the beginning is this is an example of a bad strategy, which is often a list of goals without any indication of how we're going to get to those goals. And I'd say I see that's what like 80% of organizations do. So this one goes through, starting off why that doesn't work and has lots and lots of real life examples, and then goes into what actually makes a strategy that's number one, achievable, and number two, meets all the elements of a good strategy. So it's not one where they're going to give you a template for strategy, because I don't think you can. To be honest, I think it depends on understanding your org so well that you're able to harness the strengths and minimize the weaknesses of your org to create the strategy to success. The other one, which is also a video game pick, is I've been playing a lot of World of Warcraft lately, getting ready for the next expansion pack, which I think is hitting next week at the time we're recording this. If you've followed the Warcraft storyline, there's a lot of big things that are happening and a lot of large events from the past that are being heavily referenced to. So I recommend checking it out. There's new content even now before the expansion pack is launched, and I'm looking forward to playing the expansion pack when it comes out. And that is it for me.
All right, Chris, how about you for picks?
So I did no pre-research. I think I asked you, Nathan, a couple weeks ago what the heck a pick was. And so I'm going to steal the themes, even though I have different answers. As far as books go, I think I've referenced Accelerate by Nicole Forsgren, Gene Kim, everybody else, probably 6 or 7 times since I've taken this role. And not talking about DevOps specifically, but just in general, like the processes and the measurements that they're using in the book to kind of feed back into that marketing loop, I think is important. So, you know, laying out work, for example, visualizing it is something that I'm going to work on our team with. You know, I have 1 or 2 people on board. Need to work on that a little bit more. Everyone in software, in any capacity, read it. And then the second thing, I was traveling this week and I had moments of downtime and I wanted a new game. And I heard about this cool new game called Pocket City. And it's like SimCity, but not EA crappily micro purchases and all that stuff. It's download it, you pay for it. I think it was like $4 or $5. And you can build to your heart's content. And there's no cheat codes that I know of. And you just have to like not have a crappy city and you'll have plenty of money there. And it just works like that. It's a lot simpler. Again, it's Pocket City. There's no upgrades or cheat codes or anything else. It just works. And you can just have this nice little kind of SimCity experience right there in your hand. And it was super fun to play, like waiting in line at airports and such.
Nice. That's awesome. Except you stole one of my picks. I have Accelerate right here. Also, thank you, Dr. Forsgren, for writing that along with Jez and Gene. It is a great book, and I definitely recommend it. So given that, I do have 2 other picks, though. So next pick is the DevOps Days DC conference happened back in June, and we've just now gotten around to publishing the videos. So if you want to get caught up on some awesome talks in our nation's capital, including one from Nell Shamrell Harrington, which was an amazing talk, I definitely recommend checking those out. You can look at the at DevOps Days DC Twitter to find links to all of those recordings. Also, in the next I don't want to make a commitment. So in the next year, I will take all of those talks and release them as part of the DevOps Days podcast as well. If you haven't subscribed to the DevOps Days podcast, you can check it out. We basically take talks that have been given at DevOps Days conferences, and we just take the audio and release them as a podcast. Not really the best way to consume that content, unless what you want to do is go back and listen to a talk again. Obviously, you can't see the slides there, but it's I think it's worth checking out. And then my other pick will be a new library that I've been talking about recently. A good friend of the show, in fact, one of the earliest co-founders of the Food Fight Show, Matt Ray, released this little library called Iggy. And Iggy is actually an InSpec generator. And what it will do is if you're using Terraform to spin up infrastructure and you're using InSpec to validate that infrastructure, you can point Iggy at your Terraform state files, and it will generate InSpec controls for all of the resources that are in that Terraform state file. So simply by running Iggy against your Terraform state file, you get a huge, well, depending on the size of your infrastructure that you've set up with Terraform, but you get an InSpec control for every resource that's in there, including things like your security groups, your elastic load balancers, your AMIs that you've spun up, and so forth. So check out Iggy. Of course, we'll put links to all of this in the show notes, including a link to Nell's talk, including a link to Chris's talk from ChefConf. And yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Nathan. And thank you so, so much, Chris and Julian, for joining us today. This has been a really great conversation. As always, you can check out the Food Fight Show website or follow us on Twitter and get notified about upcoming shows and when we release them. And remember the Chef Community Summits and ChefConf coming up. And have a wonderful rest of your day, everyone. And since we're recording this on a Friday, have a wonderful weekend. Take care, everyone. Food Fight!